The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of March 26th, 2018. On this week's show, we'll discuss NCAA tournament matters, including Loyola Chicago's Cinderella run to the Final Four, Duke's ouster in the Elite Eight, and whether any women's team other than UConn matters. We'll also talk about protesters blocking the entrance to the Sacramento Kings Arena after the police killing of Stephon Clark, and what that protest signifies about the state of activism in sports. And finally, we'll look at Kevin Love, DeMar DeRozan, and the conversation they started about mental health. The great and powerful Stefan Fatsis is off this week. Joining me in our DC studio is Gene Demby. Gene is a correspondent for NPR's Code Switch, a blog and podcast about race and identity. It's great to have you back, Gene.
Thank you for having me, man.
And with us from Palo Alto is Joel Anderson of ESPN, who is at the West Regional in LA to watch the Michigan Wolverines shoot 4 for 22 from three in a scintillating 4-point win over Florida State. You really know how to pick them, Joel.
Oh, man. Well, you know, I like games as much like football games as possible.
You got to, you know, a game in the 50s. That's really your speed in 2018. The star of the West Regional, Joel, was Leonard Hamilton.
Oh, my God.
The Florida State coach. Joel, you tweeted that Hamilton was a personal hero of yours for refusing to wear a button-up shirt.
Oh, yeah, and tie. Yeah, I mean, he just clearly, this was a decision he's made. I never got a chance to ask him about it, but I can't find a picture of him in a tie. So clearly this is something that he's made is a decision that he's going to go with for the rest of his life.
So you know the other thing that Leonard Hamilton doesn't do, besides wear a tie, is get his team to foul when they're down with 4 points with 11 seconds to go. Here was his explanation in an interview with CBS's Dana Jacobson after the game.
Take me through the final seconds of this game. Why didn't you guys foul?
What are you talking about?
Down the stretch there, the end of the game, the final seconds, 11 seconds left down the clock.
Do you think that the game came down to the final seconds of the game?
I'm asking you, though, why that decision in the final seconds of the game?
The game was over.
The best part of that is how saucy he is the whole time.
Well, he did the, like, shoulder turn, like he was going to walk off, and then thought better of it. How does this fit in with the Leonard Hamilton you know and love, Joel?
I think, and he did ultimately apologize for that yesterday, but I think it fits in quite well. And I think you have to take the context of his career. He's 69 years old. He's been a college basketball coach for over 30 years. He's never made it to the Final Four, right? And so he's on the cusp of it with not his most talented team. And I could see how in that moment, asking him that question would seem to imply that his team gave less than its best effort to the end of the game. And that's something that they take tremendous pride in that program. You know, the junkyard defense that they talked about all game, you know, the junkyard dog defense that they talked about all weekend. And, you know, we played for all 40 minutes. And asking him that question to
all
him,
40 minutes.
Last 11 seconds.
Right. Joel, they call their defense 39 minutes and 49 seconds of hell.
I'll tell you this. I was at the game, and it was so bizarre to watch Terrence Mann just, you know, back off and not foul. I was like, oh, maybe they know something about the clock or the score that I don't
right.
know. Like, I was like, maybe they're smarter than me, and they've calculated, they've got somebody crunching numbers, and they've concluded that they can't come back. I was like, okay, maybe I don't know what the hell was going on. And so when that came up after the game, I was like, oh, yeah, that was weird to see them give up like that. So it was that bizarre that it made me think, oh, I don't know what I'm watching right now.
Right. I mean, we're also habituated to this idea, like the procession of free throws at the end of these close games.
Yeah.
That is like so it is like really shocking to see like, wait, what is happening there? And apparently, you know, the decision not to foul was complicated by the fact that the other team is not a great free throw shooting team. Like, I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
We've all seen, you know, that the very like sluggish parade of free throw trading at the end of these games. And maybe one out of 1,000 times does this like actually like we're down to the benefit of the team that's down, right? Because they stop the clock or whatever. They stop the clock a couple times. Maybe they get the ball back and get a chance at a shot with like, you know, with a second left, right? After all that.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. The thing I didn't understand is people defending it by saying, oh, obviously they weren't going to come back and win. Well, sure. Like, but if there's like a 1% chance to win, you still got to foul the dude. The thing that I find even more bizarre about it is that Leonard Hamilton made $825,000 in bonus money based on where they progressed in the tournament. And if they won that game, he would have made another $275,000. If I have a 1% chance of getting $275,000, I am fouling.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's not like anybody had anywhere to be. We were on West Coast. it wasn't even dark outside yet. You know, it was a frustrating game for them. And there were a couple of stretches from the late first half through the second half. There were like twice that they went like, 10 minutes between field goals. And so you could, playing in that sort of a game probably had, it wore them down a little bit, because as much as they're used to doing that to people, it did not happen to them to that magnitude that year. That was the lowest shooting percentage they'd shot in a game all year, and it was the lowest point total that they'd had in a game all year. And so it's eminently possible that they were just frustrated and were like, the hell with this. And that sounds weird, but it happens a lot. I mean, it happens a lot in sports. You just don't happen to see it in those sort of situations.
Do we know, like, if Leonard Hamilton has a long history of, in those situations, down 4, down 5, whatever, with, some minimal amount of time left on the clock, of just not fouling, like, oh, the game's over. Is that an aberration?
I don't think so. There was a game like in 5 or 6 years ago against Virginia Tech, where they came back from like 8 points down with a minute to go or a minute and a half to go. So he's done it in his career. The whole thing just doesn't make much sense. I mean, there was a game in the tournament 2 years ago, Texas A&M and Northern Iowa, where A&M came back from 12 points down with 35 seconds to go.
Oh, I remember this. Yeah.
I mean, so these things happen. But let's not focus too much on our friend Leonard. I don't think it was just like a brain fart or something. Hopefully he'll get over it. But Joel, I'm curious, you tweeted the other day about how Michigan is a team that you think is just incredibly fun to watch, that you really love their game. They play kind of similar to how Loyola Chicago and Villanova plays, I feel like, in terms of shooting a bunch of threes, being very like team-oriented and not having one guy who's, playing hero ball. Is that kind of what you see from all of them, or is Michigan unique in your eyes?
No. I think that's probably right. There's a lot of motion, a lot of free flowing. They've got, big guys that can shoot, like Mo Wagner, who's, the leading scorer and the leading rebounder. There's a guy who has 3-point range and shoots close to, 40% from three. So you don't tend to see teams shoot that well in college. And I mean, it's something that it's noticeable when you see it. And I should also note that, like, college basketball is a lot better in person than it is on TV, because on TV, it looks very workmanlike, and it's very laborious. Like, you're just seeing guys, work the ball around the perimeter for, 28 seconds before firing up a shot. But you can feel the intensity and see the intensity a lot better if you're in the arena. And so it makes a little bit more sense. But given that, Michigan was notably more fun to watch than the other teams in the regional that I saw. I mean, teams I saw that weekend. Yeah, I haven't seen that much of Villanova, and maybe that's my West Coast bias. But I'm sure they're a fun team too.
Yeah, I feel like Michigan and Loyola Chicago, kind of strangely, you might not have said that before the tournament, but I feel like the talent level on those teams is even, pretty even. Like, you don't watch Loyola Chicago and be like, these guys are outmatched. I think that Villanova is clearly the best team and has that kind of team philosophy, but with just better players.
I think that's right. Because, at the end of this, people say, oh, teams are underseeded or overseeded or whatever. And I could totally understand why you might overlook Loyola Chicago, right? Like, they lost 5 games this year and they don't play in a great conference. But it's just really weird to look at a team that's an 11 seed from a mid-major conference, and they just are like taking it to teams. It's not like they're, these aren't flukes the way that they're winning. They're not winning at the buzzer. They're actually, they wore down Kansas State, and that's kind of jarring to see, right?
Well, Joel, they won their first 3 games by 4 points. I mean,
that's fair.
They did take it to Kansas State, but what are your thoughts on Loyola Chicago, Gene?
No, it's interesting because on that side of the bracket now you have Loyola Chicago and Michigan, obviously, and those are two teams that don't have I mean, obviously, Loyola Chicago has no NBA talent on it. I think there's one dude on Michigan who's supposed to come out who might be drafted in the next draft, in the upcoming draft. And so there's not a ton of NBA talent on that side of the bracket in the Final Four. On the other side, though, I mean, you have Villanova and you have Kansas, and they'll probably send a few people to the league. And so I guess Michigan has to play that style, right? They have to play this sort of where the ball moves around a lot, right? Where they get a lot of contributions mm-hmm. from a lot of people. But I guess it was interesting watching the tournament, to the extent that I was watching it up until like last weekend or the last couple of days, has been the ways that one and dones, all the big one and dones, basically, none of them covered themselves in glory. I mean, with the exception of maybe Marvin Bagley, right? Like the rest of them kind of came and went. I mean, DeAndre Ayton is done. I mean, they got like stomped by Buffalo of all teams, right? Yeah. It's not going to have any bearing. He's going to be the number one pick in the NBA draft this summer. But, you know, it's a reminder of like how much college basketball like is still like a way that the NBA is not, right? It's still like a game that you can sort of get by. I mean, talent matters, but there's experience matters a lot more, right? And if you have like a good mix of both of those things, you're just going to be way better off. I mean, Villanova is a program that has the best record in college basketball over the last 4 or 5 years, I think. And they have almost no 5-star guys, I think, going to that school at this point. I think they have some like 4-star guys there, but like no like obvious NBA players when they go to the school anyway.
Right.
And they're the best team in college basketball.
And it's weird you said that about Ayton. I think that's one of the things about one and done guys, right? Is that we see the talent. We see, you know, oh, that guy, he can jump. He's got, you know, this tremendous set of skills. But one thing you read after the game is that Buffalo said, oh, it wasn't what DeAndre Ayton could do to us. It's what we could do to him. And basically, they took advantage of his inexperience and inability to play defense, right?
So
he's not a rim protector, which, you know, may end up being a problem at the next level if he's going to be that size, right? But, like, you know, that college team figured out a way to take advantage. They were actually going at him, which you would think would happen. But, you know, that's the thing about being one and done, right? I mean, they're not all Carmelo. They're not all, like you said, Derrick Rose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're guys that are flawed and they've got a lot of talent, but they don't necessarily have all their games together. So it's like you can't count on winning. It's best to have the most talent, but it doesn't guarantee you anything, especially in, you know, a one and done scenario like that.
Absolutely.
I think that the fact that Duke didn't get past Kansas is not because they had a bunch of one-and-ones. I mean, one-and-done, sorry. Look at the performances in that game.
Mm-hmm.
Bagley only got 9 shots,
absolutely.
But he was, you know, had a double-double, I think. Wendell Carter, who's their other probably a lottery pick, the refs basically, like, fouled him out of the game. He only played 20 minutes, but he was good when he was on the floor. Duval was good. Trent was good. The dude who cost him the game was Grayson Allen.
The
experienced Teddy Senior. And if that ball, you know, the last shot had, you know, tipped over through the hoop, they would have won the game. So I'm not really buying that like Duke's lack of experience really cost them there. And the funny thing is that Duke, for like all the many years in which they were kind of like on their high horse about how, oh, we're, you know, we want 3- and 4-year players. We're not like playing this like John Calipari game. They have become like the nexus of one and done in college basketball. Next year, they're having Zion Williamson is going there. RJ Barrett, they've got the number 1, 2, and 3 recruits.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so I think it might be a different conversation a year from now about how good a strategy it is to have a bunch of freshmen on your college basketball team.
As a Philadelphian, it's just like frustrating to see Villanova suddenly become like Duke light in that way. And be sort of like Jay Wright is always talking about, you know, the Villanova way and stuff. And it's just like, I mean, I love Jay Wright. Jay Wright actually was the coach of my alma mater, Hofstra, when I was there. Yeah, I know, it's crazy, right? Like now to see Villanova, like people talk about them in that same way is like excruciating because obviously like I'm an insane American. I hate the Blue Devils and like the way they were talked about. And now Villanova, one of our local teams is suddenly like, you know, gets talked about in the same, like, oh, they play the right way. Right. And all that language is like, oh,
yeah, that's interesting.
Right. Right. Well, actually real quick, thinking about this, right? Like if this was anybody else, if this, as a thought experiment, if you had a team whose best player had 9 shots in a game, couldn't teach his team how to play man-to-man defense and scrapped it to play zone, wouldn't you be like, hey, man, that guy got out-coached? Or, like, yeah, for some reason couldn't reach those guys. Well, I haven't heard anybody say that, but I thought I'd throw that out there.
RIP to your mentions, man. Coming for you.
Yeah, I know, right?
Everybody in Durham is coming for you now.
I feel like we haven't given Loyola enough pub because this is obviously the best story of the tournament so far. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that they've become a huge story in Chicago. This is not a squad that you would think of as being like Chicago's team,
but like or somebody else. Yeah.
People are going nuts for them. And the really great thing about this is that it's bringing attention to the 1963 Loyola team. People talk about 1966 Texas Western, five black starters beating Kentucky. That's like kind of the only like, you know, civil rights landmark that people know in college basketball. But they were showing Jerry Harkness, the star of that 1963 team, on TBS all Saturday. And we're starting to hear about the story of this was actually, you know, a team that had a bunch of black starters. And at a time when, you know, these guys, you know, they played Mississippi State in the tournament. And, you know, the governor of Mississippi was basically threatening Mississippi State that if you like play these guys, then there'll be hell to pay. And like what these guys went through, it's a really important story for people to know about.
It is really good to see them back in the spotlight. The only thing that's just kind of grating is just, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm too much of a cynic for this, but it's just, you know, you hear them talking about, oh, you know, Coach Porter Moser saying, you know, this is the Loyola way. And, you know, this is, you know, this is what college basketball is all about. And I'm like, dude, okay. Yeah. Like, you didn't, you know, solve the housing segregation crisis or anything. Like,
it's the same thing. It's the same thing you were saying, Gene, about how, you know, this kind of coded language around or just propping up the NCAA with these like kind of happy stories about amateurism.
Absolutely. And, I mean, obviously like everything about college basketball is like, is shaped by race, you know, in all these like really, really powerful ways. Right. And we did an episode last week on Code Switch about, you know, the whole conversation about compensating athletes is really racially divided. So you have, according to the Washington Post, when you ask people whether college athletes should be paid, you know, there's a big racial split there. So 60% of white people say they should not be paid. 54% of black people say they should be paid. There's this way in which, like, watching the tournament, like, that this is all this weird subtext there about, like, who's rooting for who and who's playing the right way, right? All of the language around it is, like, coded, right? And it's all, I mean, especially, I mean, this is, like, why Duke has gotten on our nerves for so long, right? Because they were always, you know, held up as the school who did things the right way. But, I mean, in this system, no one is doing this the right way.
Yeah. All right, let's get to the women's tournament. UConn won its first round game 140-52, which is a strong performance. They're in the Elite Eight. They're playing on Monday night. Probably by the time you're listening to this podcast, they will or will not have made the Final Four. I know what I'm betting on. but it's a really dumb and tired and old conversation around, are they bad for women's basketball? But The but here is, I do feel like other stories in the women's game do get obscured by their greatness. You know, Shea Serrano of The Ringer is trying to beat the drum for Oregon, and their star player, Sabrina Ionescu, who's awesome.
She's amazing.
You should watch her highlights. But wondering what you guys think about her or about this idea that, like, maybe we're missing a bunch of stuff by focusing on the 140-52.
I think there is some truth to that, but I also think that UConn, in a way, can sort of highlight the other players because last year, I mean, we got familiar with Mississippi State as a result, right? And I think there was, I don't know what the ratings were for the game. I'm pretty sure it wasn't as high as it was when UConn is normally in the title game. But, like, we were introduced to South Carolina and Mississippi State by virtue of the fact that UConn had lost. Like, I mean, it would be great if, you know, there were teams, you know, of the caliber of the old Pat Summitt Tennessee teams that were able to go up against them, especially since Pat Summitt and Gino Auriemma hated each other much, right? But
yeah, they hated.
But I do think that, like, they're useful for reflecting their greatness on the other people, and so we, you know, in that way, we get familiar with other teams, and you know. I mean, nobody complains. I mean, this is a tired argument in that way, but, like, nobody complains when there are other dominant teams in other sports. Nobody complains when Usain Bolt, you know, dominates the 100-meter field every year. We don't know who the the second fastest person in the world is, right? So I think that they can be useful, and I think they draw attention to the game. I don't know how it could be bad, you know. So
obviously one of the more exciting things that happened in the tournament on the women's side was Kennedy Carter's game winning shot, Texas A&M, which is obviously, she's like probably she might be the biggest star leaving this tournament. I mean, Texas A&M has been eliminated since, but I mean, she obviously had the piece in the Players Tribune talking about, you know, like just how she wanted to have Allen Iverson swag. But that shot was like everywhere, right? The shot was all over Twitter. So it's like, there's 10 seconds left. She takes the most insane, probably ill-advised pull-up that you could take as a freshman, right? She comes on the court. She has a teammate cutting to the basket, and she pulls up for three and nails it, which, of course, is amazing, but also is like, she was talking about having Allen Iverson swag, but it's one of those things like, you almost get the sense that she doesn't know. like it's courage if you're scared and you do it anyway. But she almost didn't know that was like a bad shot to take. She had like that J.R. Smith like irrational confidence thing happen. Like, yo, I'm just gonna pull up and go. I wonder if this puts the Aggies on the map a little bit. Even though this was like far removed from the orbit of UConn and their dominance, because she's a freshman, she'll be around for another couple years. And they'll be able to like have this like legit star be sort of the lodestone for like recruiting and a bunch of other stuff like that. But like, yeah, the problem is always that like, this is like us talking about NBA basketball, right? Like, we can have all these other interesting storylines about who the MVP is or whatever, but like at the end of the day, like, I mean, well, maybe not this year, but the you know, the title goes through Golden State, right? But there's a way in which like, there's still other stories that are useful or sort of that are like fun to follow when we like to look away a little bit.
Well, the idea of swag in women's basketball is really interesting because, you know, with the rise of Steph Curry and the NBA, like one of the things, you know, beyond his like amazing shooting ability, one of the things that people love the most about him is like the stuff that he does pregame. Absolutely. With like his warm-up routine and his like the way that he can dribble and get shots off from wherever on the court. Some of the stuff that we like love the most now about, you know, the best NBA players is like stuff that is like below the rim. And so I think you're seeing that with Ionescu.
That's right.
And I think she'll only continue to get better. Mm-hmm. She like already has the record for most triple doubles as a woman in Division I, like, and she's a sophomore.
Which is, how is that possible? Like, that doesn't,
I mean, I gotta like, right. I gotta hate on the other women that came before her a little bit because like, it doesn't seem like that's that much of a record to be beating, but no, right. still respect to her for getting triple doubles.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Before we get to Stephon Clark and the state of activism in sports, wanted to let you know that in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, Gene and Joel and I are going to talk about a piece in the Players Tribune by Steve Francis, who talks about going from being a drug dealer to an NBA star and the circuitous route that he took to get there. It's a good segment. It'll be a good segment. And if you are listening to this, probably means you're a fan of the show. Why don't you want to listen to that? It's good. You'll enjoy it. To get it, join Slate Plus for just $35 a year. You can sign up at slate.com/hangoutplus. On the night of Sunday, March 18th in Sacramento, two police officers killed 22-year-old Stephon Clark in his backyard. Clark, who is black, was suspected of breaking windows. He was not armed. He was shot 20 times. After the Sacramento Police Department released video and audio footage of Clark's killing, protesters blocked a highway and shut down the entrance to the Sacramento Kings Arena, preventing fans from entering and delaying the start of Thursday's game between the Kings and Hawks. After the game, Kings owner Vivek Ranadive went on the floor and grabbed a microphone. Here's what he had to say.
We here at the Kings recognize that we have a big platform. It's a privilege, but it's also a responsibility. It's a responsibility that we take very seriously. And we stand here before you, old, young, black, white, brown, and we are all united in our commitment.
On Sunday, players from the Kings and the Boston Celtics took the court wearing T-shirts that said "Accountability, We Are One" on the front and had Stephon Clark's name on the back. They also released this public service announcement.
These tragedies have to stop.
There must be accountability.
Black, white,
brown.
We are one.
We are one.
One.
We will not stick to sports.
We will not shut up and dribble.
This is bigger than basketball.
Change can be uncomfortable.
Change is necessary. We need to talk.
We need to act.
We matter.
We must unite.
Say his name.
Stephon Clark.
Stephon Clark. We must unite.
The sad truth, Jane, is that we've seen a lot of this before. Obviously, the killing of an unarmed black man, we've seen that a bunch of times before. Mm-hmm. We've seen NBA players or WNBA players or NFL players wearing shirts that say, I can't breathe, or Philando Castile, Alton Sterling, Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. But protesters blocking an NBA arena, that's something we had not seen before.
I think what was interesting about Rana Diva's response is the politics of the fan base for the NBA sort of required a response that, if not exactly that response, then a response that would have been at least sympathetic to the problem that's being discussed, right? So what we know about NBA fans is that they skew Democratic, right? They tend to be urban. The majority of NBA television fans are people of color. They're a little bit younger than the NFL's fans, who are older, who are much whiter. I think like 70-something percent of the NFL's television audience is white. They tend to skew slightly Republican in their voting. And so there's, I think, an expectation around issues of police violence that there's a way in which conversations about issues of police violence in the NBA have to play out differently. I think there's like different expectations for what is, I think, what the fans would want from their players. It's interesting that the WNBA has been even more outspoken, and their audience, their fan base skews even more Democratic. They have by far the most left-leaning fan base of in American sports. And so there's a way in which the players, and I guess the coaches, and in the case of Rana Diva, the owners, are insulated from some of the criticisms that have greeted NFL players when they've sort of taken similar stands.
The one thing that is really sort of difficult to parse here with the NBA and other people that other professional leagues that want to make statements around police violence is, there's always sort of a blurring of the lines between what actually is activism and what is philanthropy, right? And it is very important and it's very useful to have people with a platform to make these statements and say, hey, look, this is unacceptable. But the problem is that they don't say that. They don't say that it's unacceptable. They say we need to unite.
Right.
We need to have a conversation. The time is now. We are one. These are not actually things that are true, right? we are not one. We are not united. And a conversation is useful in as much as it gets started, conversations about policy and like trying to determine who's accountable and how you're going to hold them accountable. And that next step never seems to happen. We've kind of just been stuck at these symbolic gestures and it's never really advanced past that. And I don't know that it's the NBA's responsibility to make it advance past that, but it's just hard not to be cynical and to not think that, okay, they're doing this to placate a fan base and people that were really upset that night. It blocked their business. And so you could say that the Kings felt a responsibility to say something that night because that protects their business. But I'm curious to know what happens next.
It's interesting to think about Colin Kaepernick and how much people were unwilling to hear what he had to say because of what he was saying or because of the way that he initiated his protest. And I think it's both. But if you just separate out the whole like kneeling during the national anthem part, I think Kaepernick was saying, when asked, the things that you're kind of asking for, Joel. He was talking about systems and about power and not saying kumbaya, we're all in this together. And, the clips that we heard at the beginning of this segment, I think it's an important question. Is it important or is it good enough at this moment, that they just said something, even if what they said is incredibly banal and maybe not even correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important that they said something, and I think it's good, right? You don't want them to pretend that it didn't happen, and you don't want them, you don't want to create the conditions where people say that this is acceptable in our society. So they've got that covered. I mean, it's just really interesting because we actually know who is to blame here. We know who bears the responsibility for accountability, but you can't say it, or they won't say it.
It's not like Ron Adive was going out at midcourt and being like, we need to fire these cops.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, right. I mean, there, he could have done that. He just said, you know, I hope that the Sacramento Police Department and, you know, our local county prosecutor or whatever, that, you know, they take action on this, or that, you know, that they handle this case with, you know, above board and, you know, with the utmost seriousness and blah, 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 blah. But like, that's not what happened. And maybe, you know, that's an uncomfortable thing to say. And maybe you don't want to put yourself out there like that. But if you're going to advance the conversation, if you're actually going to make some sort of an impact, if you want to make an impact, you're not going to be able to not piss some people off. And right now, that just kind of seems to be the priority, to tell people that we care, but without pissing people off. And I just don't know how you really make an impact if you don't go that next step.
It's also worth noting, though, that like the labor arrangements in the NBA versus the NFL, right, allow players to be a little bit more outspoken, right? I mean, they have guaranteed contracts, right? And so they can sort of say what's on their mind. Like, I mean, Eric Reed is, you know, a quality NFL defensive back. And it's basically like, look, like I won't, if it's going to cost me my job or cost me a future contract, I'll stop kneeling. I'll stop protesting, at least in this way.
And he was the most steadfast.
Mm-hmm.
He was right next to Kaepernick from day one. And then when guys like Malcolm Jenkins started to kind of negotiate with ownership in this way, like, you know, that made Reed uncomfortable, he was like, I'm never going to stop doing this. And it just made me incredibly sad that now he's out there unsigned. It seems obvious why. And it seems like, I mean, I don't blame him, but it seems like he's capitulated.
Like, I think it's instructive on where the NFL owners and the power structure lies. And I mean, same with the NBA, too. Like, cause let's not forget that, like, Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf and, like, Craig Hodges, you know, they never really found their way back into the NBA after they made their own, you know, sorts of activist stands. But with Eric Reed, I mean, you know, all the money that the NFL teams are giving, you know, these partnerships, and they're going on these listening tours, everything else. I mean, this all started because they wanted Colin Kaepernick to get a job. That doesn't appear that it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, it might potentially end the career of the guy that stood alongside him the whole way. And that's incredibly discouraging, but it's instructive on like where their allegiances actually are, where their political allegiances actually are.
I mean, it was remarkable to see Johnny Manziel like trying out last week for a bunch of pro teams, right? And it was like, of all people, right? Like, this is a dude who actually is just not good enough to be in the NFL, right? Like, he's not an NFL quality quarterback, right? He is getting a shot, whereas Kaepernick has a much, like, obviously his record is much more decorated, and obviously, like, there's a, you know, you can argue over like whether or not he should start or whatever, but he should at least be on an NFL roster, right?
Did you see that Manziel was tweeting about, like, I don't like when people pit me and Colin against
each
other?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was like,
and he was very thoughtful about it too.
It was, especially for Johnny Manziel.
Was not someone we associate with thoughtfulness, but he was saying like, look, like he's like, and he said that the reason that Kaepernick doesn't have a job is because, you know, Kaepernick is standing up, is speaking up for these racial issues. Which is, you know, remarkable to hear from Johnny Manziel, but it is striking that, like, I mean, the sort of contorting that's happening in the NFL around not bringing Kaepernick in to try out for a spot, but especially like Eric Reed, who is like, by all accounts, is just a quality NFL player, right? He doesn't have, you know, like, you can just sort of argue that Kaepernick, I mean, there's a whole bunch of stupid arguments around systems and like whether or not he like whether his success was like contextual or whatever. But like, Eric Reed is a good NFL player and he's not going to have a job. And that's because of the politics of the NFL. And it's because of the assumed politics, the presumed politics of the NFL's fan base.
You make a really good point, Joel, about the NBA players and the security. Like, De'Aaron Fox is a rookie for the Kings. Like, he's maybe their best known player, if you like disregard Vince Carter. But he could, like, if I have no idea what De'Aaron Fox's politics are, but he could come out and be like, these police officers need to be fired, and he would still have a job.
Still have a job, bro.
Like, And I don't know if that means he needs to do that or should do that, but you know, we heard some player in that PSA said, we're not going to shut up and dribble, like referring to the Laura Ingraham thing about LeBron James. But like, I think NBA players recognize and understand that they do have the ability to speak up maybe in a way that NFL players, you know, that NFL players can't. And so it'll be interesting to see how they use that power and what they choose to say.
You know, Tamir Rice, you know, the police shooting of Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old boy, happened right in LeBron's backyard. And LeBron didn't say anything. And I'm not saying that he has to say anything. Like, I mean, you know, that's his prerogative. But there's not a player in the NBA who has more power or influence or platform than that guy.
In the history of the NBA. Like, I mean,
the history of the sport.
Mm-hmm.
And he chose to not say anything about it or the police department there. We have these expectations of NBA players and say, oh, they could do this. They could join the fight. You know, they've got this voice. And I'm just like, but, you know, maybe they're just rich guys who, you know, they do care, but they also have their own brands to protect. I guess you'd have to show me where they've, you know, really been hardline on these sorts of things, or even in the way that Eric Reid has.
And it's a reminder of, like, how courageous, whether or not you agree with Colin Kaepernick or not, like how courageous his stance is, right? I mean, he's talking to probably a fan base that is like in the aggregate, like diametrically opposed to what he's saying. And his career, I mean, his career is very likely over because of it, right? And he's saying it, I think, and to Josh's point, in a much more like unalloyed, direct way than even NBA players who have way more job security. Especially NBA stars are not saying, and so that's I think it speaks again to just how audacious and courageous Kaepernick has been in this whole situation.
And on LeBron, like I think it's totally fair to criticize him there, but it was, you know, Tamir Rice was 3.5 years ago, which is not that long. But I feel like LeBron is kind of a different guy than he was maybe even that short period ago. Like he seems more confident, secure in his beliefs. Mm-hmm. He's said a lot of stuff in the last few years that maybe he wouldn't have said earlier in his career.
He tweeted at Donald Trump, you bum.
Point well taken. So I'll be curious to see what he says and does or doesn't say and do in this event.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Earlier this month, the Cleveland Cavaliers' Kevin Love published a piece in the Players Tribune about having a panic attack during a game in November. He wrote, "It was a wake-up call, that moment. I thought the hardest part was over after I had the panic attack. It was the opposite. Now I was left wondering why it happened and why I didn't want to talk about it. Call it a stigma or call it fear or insecurity. You can call it a number of things, but what I was worried about wasn't just my own inner struggles, but how difficult it was to talk about them. I didn't want people to perceive me as somehow less reliable as a teammate, and it all went back to the playbook I'd learned growing up." Love said in the piece that he'd been inspired by the Raptors' DeMar DeRozan, who tweeted in February, "The depression gets the best of me." DeRozan later told the Toronto Star, "It's one of them things that no matter how indestructible we look like we are, we're all human at the end of the day. We all got feelings, all of that. Sometimes it gets the best of you, or times everything in the world is on top of you." A lot of different directions that we could go here. I mean, I'm interested both in the subject matter and players talking about their feelings and talking about depression, and also just in the platform that they've used and the way that they've chosen to get the message out. Gene, what do you make of the Kevin Love thing and him crediting DeMar DeRozan?
That was just as a huge NBA fan, that was a remarkable couple of days, right? Because DeMar DeRozan said this, and you know, all these other NBA players started tweeting him like, "We got you." Like, you know, they were really supportive. Kevin Love came out a few days later in the Players Tribune and talked about his struggles with anxiety, and it was really remarkable, one, because like in Kevin Love's essay, there's a bunch of stuff in there. There's like the construction of masculinity in there, right? Like in him sort of like, he said like, you know, he was scared to be found out. And I remember, you know, when he left the court that game, the game that was under question, like that was sort of, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, that was around the time that like the Cavaliers had all this internal intrigue about like Kevin Love is not showing up. He like left the sidelines. And it was really interesting to think about like, oh, this is a person who is just actually dealing with a bunch of stuff, right? And it's not about sort of him being aloof or not being a team player, but actually like struggling. And it changed.
Everyone is going through something was the headline.
Of right. Absolutely. And it changed, I think, a lot of people's read of, you know, like, oh, Kevin Love was just like, he just abandoned his team that was struggling at the time. Right. And it changed. I think everyone, like a lot of people read that much more sympathetically after his essay came out. But also, and I hate to go back to labor again, but it also like speaks volumes about how much job security matters for NBA players. Right. I mean, I think there's a way in which in a sport like football that talking about these things publicly might have sort of negative consequences for your career in some way. And I think there's a way in which NBA players enjoy some protections that allow people to sort of to operate with a little bit more leeway in terms of the stuff they can talk about. I should say, personally, watching DeRozan play this season, he's played his best basketball of his career this year.
Yeah.
And it's sort of complicated the way I understand depression, right? It's like, here's this guy who's operating on, like, I mean, he's shooting career highs from three. Like, he's playing fantastic defense. He's always been a fantastic scorer. But he's having the best season of his career. And he's still saying, like, I struggle with this. Like,
yeah.
And I always, I think that complicated my own understanding of depression as being this thing that is, like, incapacitating for a lot of people.
You know what's interesting, though? We kind of overlooked Ron Artest in all this.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, I feel like Ron Artest was one of the very first guys. Like, mm-hmm. after he won, you know, after he helped Kobe win that championship in 2000.
He saved Kobe's ass, yes, yes.
He saved Kobe's ass, right, yes.
He thanked his therapist, and, right, yeah.
Right, and, you know, he's been kind of outspoken about, you know, going to therapy and going mm-hmm. to anger management and how it's helped him. And I think I don't watch this show on Big Brother, Celebrity Big Brother, the one with Omarosa.
We had an
anxiety attack on that.
You got lies, all right, safe space.
Yeah, right. I watched it, I would admit it. But I did not miss it. But yeah, you know, so like that's a guy of a sort. But I just wonder if there's something about Ron Artest that doesn't seem quite
right.
Accessible, like Kevin Love or DeMar DeRozan, who seem like much, I guess, for lack of a better term, like much more like regular guys. Like, yeah.
Part of Ron Artest's reputation was that he was crazy, right? Like, I mean, and that's like loaded in all these ways, but like that was like, oh, he's crazy, right? And that's ableist.
Yeah.
Well, the other guy was Royce White, who came into the league, first round draft pick by the Rockets, and was very out front about his anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and he's talked this past week about like, why wasn't anybody there for me
mm-hmm.
when I had these issues and kind of brought these to the fore, and people were like, who is this guy? He hasn't done anything.
Mm-hmm.
Why is he like making all these demands? And that's why I think the marketing here, I don't know how like conscious somebody like Kevin Love is about how he's packaging this, but mm-hmm. it's pretty clear that the way that he was perceived is, as you said, it's like he's a regular guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the important thing, and this is back to our previous conversation, he and DeMar DeRozan, they're not asking anyone to do anything.
Sure, that's right. Mm-hmm.
They're just like, here's like my story. And then people will be like, thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. And like, all they're asking is for people to give them a plus one or a thumbs up. Or, you know, Kevin Love said that they got 6,000 emails in like 3 days. And I don't mean to be blasé, and this is like helped, I'm sure, huge numbers of people, both directly and indirectly, by having this conversation out there. I'm just saying that in order to start that conversation, you need somebody who's like a friendly,
mm-hmm.
uncomplicated mm-hmm. figure, rather than somebody like Ron Artest or Royce White.
And Royce White was actually making some pretty serious demands. I think he was drafted by the Rockets, right? His anxiety made it so that he couldn't fly, right? And he was sort of saying he wanted
to be on a bus.
He wanted to take a bus to the games. And they're like, I mean, and look, the NBA could, the Houston Rockets could probably find some alternative means of travel for him. They could just say, we'll only play you in home games or something, right? We'll only play you in games that are like driving distance. There is some arrangement they could have entered into with him that could have ameliorated some of this problem. But instead, he's out of the league. I think he's playing in Canada right now. But he was making demands of his employers, like, in order for me to be functional as a basketball player, this is a thing I need from you guys. And they were like, no, right? And so that's, I mean, to your point, like, he was making an ask that I think will make a lot of people uncomfortable. I think if you open it up to like random sports fans, they're like, no, like, this is the rules for everybody. This should be the rules for you. But that's sort of the problem, right?
Yeah.
Right. Well, it's sort of instructive, right? Because, I mean, the one thing about DeMar DeRozan and Kevin Love is that they're valuable. They're all-stars. And they're guys that teams are going to make concessions for. And we would learn probably a lot more about how open the NBA is to this stuff and, you know, the consideration of the issues with it. It's more telling how they treat Royce White than how they treat DeMar DeRozan and how they give them space. And, you know, like you said, Royce White made some great points. But, I mean, the thing is that the NBA, you know, they've got the money, they've got the resources, they can do all this, and they're not great at handling mental health. And that's the same as every other industry in the world. Like, it's very difficult. If you're DeMar DeRozan and you're Kevin Love, you've got the money, you've got the resources, you can say, hey, I have these problems, and people are willing to work with you through that. Whereas, you know, Royce White is probably a little bit more of avatar for the rest of us. Is that, you know, man, if you can't show up to work, you know, your employer might get rid of you.
Absolutely.
There was a video on the Players Tribune of Kevin Love talking to Channing Frye, who's not on the Cavs anymore, but was a teammate of his. And Channing Frye talked about how he had a lot of, you know, anxiety problems around, you know, he had a heart condition. Mm-hmm. His parents both died within a month of each other. He talked about driving to the practice facility and crying the whole time that he's driving, and talked about how his teammates really supported him through that period. And we, you know, as sports fans, we talk about team chemistry in the context of like how guys play together on the court. But I was just thinking and listening to that conversation, it's like, this is your workplace. Mm-hmm. And irrespective of how, you know, well you get along with somebody on the court, like, it's going to make a huge difference for your quality of life and mental health if you have just like guys around who you can like talk to and open up to. And it seemed like the Cavs, you know, were able to do that for Channing Frye. There's some apparent issues in the Cavs locker room this year. And the interesting thing there is that, like, you know, Isaiah Thomas is the one who's like been blamed for that. And that guy has gone through a tremendous amount with his sister being killed in a car accident. And like Kevin Love said, everybody's going through something.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm wondering, Joel, if like you, when you were playing football, if you had teammates that you could like talk about stuff with, like, did this hit home for you? Like, what was that atmosphere like?
It's interesting that you asked me that, because I was thinking about this and I was like, yo, like, I don't want to say crippling anxiety, but before games, I would get extremely nervous. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just something that, you know, I would bobble the ball or just, I just had like these issues. Dylan, I always wondered, I was like, do other people feel like this? I just like, are other people nervous, you know, going out in front of these games? And it's something nobody would ever talk about. Nobody could ever talk to it. And the one instance I can think of a guy that, hey man, I'm not feeling a little confident right now. After he'd given up an 80-yard touchdown to us, it was a joke. Like, everybody laughed at it. You know, it was something like, it was a sign of weakness among our team for like a couple of years.
Oh.
And so, yeah, man. So it's just really, I wondered about that, about how these guys, I was like, don't they ever get nervous? Don't they ever have anxiety issues? Like, and how do they ever come back from that?
And that's just like stigma. So, I mean, that's just stigma talking about on-field stuff.
That's
like,
right.
Yeah,
you can't even. I mean, I couldn't even imagine like bringing in off-field stuff if people are going to laugh at you about like saying that, you know, you gave up a touchdown pass.
I was reading about Per Mertesacker from Arsenal, the center back for Arsenal, and he was saying like he's retiring at the end of this season, at the end of this campaign, and he was basically like, yo, like, for my entire career, like, I would have like debilitating anxiety before matches, right? Like, he was saying, like, he would have like, he had to stop, change the way he ate, because he would have like violent diarrhea because of nerves before games. And he was just saying like, it would happen, and his whole roommate would always point out like, yo, the night before you go to bed, you like would like shake in your sleep. Like, he was saying that it was like, it was taking so much of a toll on him, like, and like you said, that's just like on field stuff. That was like him being worried about the fact that, like, the way he was perceived publicly was entirely based on his on pitch performance, right?
Yeah.
And how, like, that was the metric that, like, everyone was going to look at him, like, the prism through which everyone was going to view him, and how debilitating it was. And he said, like, he wants to sort of, like, bring more attention to that. But we don't think of those things as, like, mental health issues, right? We think of them as, like, oh, like, if someone, you know, someone is suddenly not performing or they're nervous, you know, they have the yips or whatever, right? Like, you know what I mean? We don't think of those things as, like, mental health problems. And I also thought about, like, Kevin Love in particular. You know, he plays with LeBron James. And if there's, like, any person who was sort of, like, this, like, paragon of, like, both of masculinity but also of, like, stability, right? I mean, like, he's never been injured, right? Like, I'm trying to imagine when we talk about, like, masculinity in these sports, we often talk about, like, the people who are held up as, like, men's men are people who, like, go through all this stuff and just sort of soldier through, right? Going back to Brett Favre, like, it was sort of the deification of Brett Favre was all around the fact that he never missed a game. But LeBron has played 15 years at an incredible level and has never gotten hurt. And I just imagine that some other thing that's informing is, like, the template for which people have of, like, excellence is this sort of, like, this sort of flawless execution without sort of any, like, and, like, boundless confidence, right? And, like, if you fall short of that, I imagine that must be really, really scary and jarring.
Yeah, and this obviously happened at a different time, right? But, like, just think about, like, the narratives that went around Kobe as he was going through his rape case in Colorado and going back and forth and playing in playoff games. And people, like, actually were giving him, they were praising him for his ability to focus and compartmentalize during that time, right?
Which is crazy.
And so, like, you have to look at how that, maybe that would have affected anybody else in the locker room that was like, well, man, you know, I mean, Kobe... You know, Kobe, you know, is going through this rape trial and or this rape case and somehow coming back and showing up and, you know, playing to the best of his ability. I just, you wonder what sort of, like, what sort of message that sends to everybody else in there, if they feel comfortable about opening up or, like, voicing their problem, because, you know, we don't really have the language or any mechanisms for dealing with those sort of people. You know,
absolutely.
I just think about Nick Anderson, man.
That was exactly what I was thinking about, right?
Yeah, man, that guy, he crumbled in front of us and never really recovered.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess nobody wants to be that guy, you know?
Yeah, missing those free throws in the finals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great point. And LeBron, man, he's got to live up to Michael Jordan.
Absolutely.
LeBron's got his stuff he's got to deal with, too. I'm always stepping up at the end of the segment to defend LeBron.
Because he needs all the defense in the world, right? If only LeBron James could find some way to muddle through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when he did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now it is time for After Balls. Before we get started, we've got to anoint our After Ball name for the week. And I was looking back at that Loyola Chicago team. One of the, like, crazy things about that 63 team that won the NCAA title was the game against Cincinnati went into overtime, 45 minutes. They had five guys play the whole game. No,
wow.
No subs.
Wow.
So the refs were, like, on their side that day.
Nobody got fouled out.
Yeah, they were Iron Men. But I was doing a little bit more reading, and it wasn't necessarily by choice. Two of their best players were dropped from the team in the middle of the year because they didn't have the grades. Based on what I read, it was like a fraction of a point. Who knows?
Wow.
Who knows how accurate that is? But one of the guys who got dropped from the Loyola Chicago title squad was this guy, Pablo Robertson, who was 5'7". He won the MVP of the Rucker Pro Tournament in 1969, six years after he was on Loyola. And he was on the Harlem Globetrotters. He was one of their, like, dribbling specialists.
Mm.
And his primary claim to fame is that he was one of the characters on the 1970s Harlem Globetrotters animated television show.
The Hanna-Barbera one?
I believe so.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy did not get an NCAA title, but he did get to be an animated Harlem Globetrotter. So, like, trade-offs. he died in 2015, unfortunately, so he's not around to get his due now. But Pablo Robertson, we're going to give him his due on the podcast today.
Shout out to Pablo.
Yeah. Who wants to go?
Shout out to Pablo.
Who wants to go first? Gene, you want to go first?
Sure. My after ball is sort of just it's a frustration that is like born of some good things, I guess, I suppose, in the aggregate, in the grand scheme of things. All NBA seasons are sort of defined by injuries in some way, right? Some star gets hurt, whatever. Obviously, you guys have talked about Markelle Fultz's phantom mysterious injury.
Yeah.
That no one has figured out what exactly happened there. As a Sixers fan, has been like incredibly frustrating.
I got to stop you and say congratulations on the Sixers making the playoffs. I meant to do that earlier.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's a big day for you.
They've clinched a winning big record for the first time. Yeah, I know. Between the Eagles and the – man, it's what a time to be alive.
If you left Villanova, this would really – I mean
– I know. It'd be great. It's too much. It's too much. It's like going from worst to first, it feels like. But like this season, like the Fultz thing sort of has been frustrating, but also like watching the Kawhi Leonard saga play out has been this season has been defined by these phantom injuries that nobody knows, like that we like have no like intel on, right? Kawhi Leonard's been out all season with this injury, this like quad injury that by all accounts is healed, right? At this point, it's like threatened to completely destabilize like one of the model franchises in professional sports, right? Like apparently they had a very testy team meeting a couple of days ago, being like, yo, man, when are you coming back? Like, what are you doing right now? He's been cleared for weeks now to play, I think. And the same thing happened with Markelle Fultz, which is like Brett Brown, the Sixers coach, was like, you know, Markelle can decide whether he wants to come back or not. And I'm just sort of wondering if we're going to enter into this era whereby, because players have so much agency now, which is a good thing, which is an unalloyed good thing for those players, if we're going to enter into this universe in which that happens more and more often. And remember just a few years ago when Derrick Rose sat out after he, like, one of his many injuries. And he basically said, like, I'm not going to come back this season. And he was, like, criticized pretty heartily, like, in the press because of that decision. And now I think people are a little bit less frustrated with we as fans are less frustrated with Kawhi Leonard and Markelle Fultz outside of just being confounded about what's happening there. It does seem like we're going to enter into this space in which more and more, especially players who like Markelle Fultz is projected to be a star and Kawhi Leonard is obviously one of the four or five best players in the NBA. We're just not going to know like what's going on because more and more people are going to be like fuck the team doctors. Like I'm going to avail myself of my own doctors and they're going to tell and I'm going to follow their advice or follow my own counsel on this, which is something that like would not have happened 10, 15, 20 years ago. It's both a very good thing that these players have the agency and the authority to make those decisions. But I bet we're walking into a world where even like, you know, the incredible basketball intel provided to us by like Woj or whatever, like even we still won't be able to figure out like what the hell is going on. Like here are two very important NBA players and nobody can tell us anything about what is happening with them. And so that's the thing I'm sort of like fascinated by and maybe a little frustrated by, but they got to do what they got to do.
Such weird stories. Like the Kawhi thing, I think Kawhi and Markelle Fultz both benefit from the markets that they're playing in different ways. Kawhi, just because San Antonio is like just enough off the beaten path. Like, can you imagine him trying to do this in New York?
Oh, no, not at all. Right.
Or LA.
Oh, yeah. Like, he also got a ring with them. So, you know, like, you know.
He's just like, he's great and everybody knows that he's great, but he's just not like top of mind. And he's just like gone under the radar. I feel like he wouldn't have been able to do in another market. And with Fultz, like, you know, we're here congratulating Gene for the Sixers making the playoffs. Like,
right.
There's enough other, like, happy, good stuff going on in Philly that, like, even for, like, how insane his story is, there's just, like, other stuff that people want to talk about.
Absolutely.
So I can just imagine both of those guys being in different circumstances and becoming, like, pariahs but with the exact same behavior.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if the Sixers don't make the playoffs, if the Sixers win 35 games this year, the conversation about Markelle Fultz is, like, you should have come back and help. Yeah. You know, they don't have enough shooting, right? Yeah. There would have been a whole bunch of different conversation about him holding out or sitting out.
Yeah.
And Kawhi has this, like, credibility built up from, like, the kind of guy that he was, you know, which is basically a silent one. But, you know, that buys you a lot of credibility with fans and other people. And so, you know, you just it is interesting that people haven't been willing to, like, get out there and jump on him for it. But, yeah, I mean, he may find out because San Antonio kind of can hide you a little bit. And if he somehow were to end up in L.A. and, like you said, New York, the narrative on him could change really, really quickly. So.
Yeah.
All right, Joel, what do you got for us? What's your Pablo Robertson?
Yeah, right. Well, I know that we were, without giving it away, that owners are a topic here. And I wanted to talk a little bit about Bob McNair. I grew up in Houston, loving my, now long gone Houston Oilers.
Condolences. Wait, do you root for the Texans or the Titans? Or do you not root for either of those teams?
I don't root for anybody
anymore. Okay.
Yeah. as a result of this. Mm-hmm. I love you, Blue, and I can't love anybody else in quite the same way. and so, obviously I was a kid, I was a kid when the Oilers were in Houston, and so there wasn't Wikipedia, there wasn't Google, so there wasn't a lot of ways that I could find out about the politics of the owner of the Oilers at the time, who was Bud Adams. But what I did know about him is that he was willing to go get Warren Moon from Canada and make him the face of a Southern NFL franchise, which, there were not a lot of black quarterbacks in the NFL at the time. Even fewer of them were the quarterbacks in the face of franchises down in the South. Mm-hmm. That meant something. And so now I kind of wonder if I would have been better off not knowing the politics of some of my hometown team's owners. Or the ones that I wanted to root for. People always ask me, they're like, yo, Joel, do you root for the Texans? Just like you did. I was like, nah. And it had nothing to do with Bob McNair. It just had to do with, I haven't lived in Houston, full time since 1996. And, I relate to sports a little bit differently now. I only root for my alma mater. But even if I wanted to root for the Texans, Bob McNair would probably make that difficult. And part of the reason he's in the news again now, I think it was yesterday, for coming to the defense of Carolina Panthers owner Jerry Richardson, a character who was clearly created from an antebellum narrative, right? the allegations against Jerry Richardson do not make him much of an empathetic character. This is a dude who This isn't just somebody who's from another era who says these charmingly impolitic things like your grandfather, or, you're right. No, this is a guy who's accused of asking female employees if he could shave their legs, offering to pay for their manicures, getting them alone in his office and then asking them to give him a foot massage. There were other employees that accused him of giving back rubs that lingered too long or went too low below the spine. He had employees refer to him as Mister. And there was also this weird thing with the seatbelt maneuver, which, I guess if you were 17 years old and a perv and you're trying to reach over, your date, you can imagine what the seatbelt maneuver is. Just use your imagination. But apparently this is where the sympathies of Bob McNair lie. And I guess it shouldn't be a big surprise, but he said, talking to the media before this week's owners meeting, he was like, I know Jerry. He's an outstanding person. Some of the comments he might have made could have been made jokingly and misunderstood. I'm sure he didn't mean to offend anybody. Well, I just gave you the litany of allegations and accusations against Jerry Richardson. It's not, these aren't comments. These aren't just comments, right? These are a laundry list of allegations of, using his power in a particularly, perverse way. But keeping this in mind about Bob McNair, earlier this fall, he apologized for saying we can't have the inmates running the prison. He was referring to players during an owner's only meeting. In 2015, he donated and then retracted $10,000 for the opponents of an equal rights ordinance in Houston. And in between, he's been reported to have been one of the NFL's largest political donors. Some of those donations have gone to, people like Marco Rubio and all these other, he gave $1 million to Donald Trump's inauguration ball, and that's fine. You can have your politics, but that's kind of, where he stands right now. And so I guess I think about all that, and I think about, Houston and football and growing up loving, those Oilers. And I just think, man, couldn't we get Bud Adams back?
No, it's funny. After the Eagles won, I kept, the thing I was actually rooting for, one of the things I was quietly thinking to myself was yo, I hope Jeff Lurie doesn't say anything that will make me livid. You know what I mean? There's a way in which, a lot of those dudes are have such unfathomable wealth and they're insulated from, the consequences of some of the stuff they say or do. And, you know, it's just like, I think we're like long overdue to have a reckoning about a lot of this stuff, that especially the way that people have treated their employees, particularly female employees. But like, man, that was one of the things like hovering over like a lot. Like, I imagine a lot of sports fans are probably like, I don't want to know the sort of potentially like revanchist politics of the billionaire owner who runs my beloved sports teams.
Oh yeah. Think about anything that you love and what you may end up hating. I mean, whether that's, you know, the easiness of Amazon Prime or, you know, the affordable prices of Walmart, or, you know, being able to communicate with your family on Facebook, you know.
There's no ethical consumption under capitalism, right?
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
So my team, my beloved childhood team, did not leave the New Orleans Saints. Yeah, and I'm going to get it. I'm going to get into why.
Okay.
Let's hear it. So the Saints owner, Tom Benson, who also owns the Pelicans now, the NBA team, died a few weeks ago at the age of 90. He was celebrated in the city on Friday with a second line through the French Quarter. Mm-hmm. Drew Brees and Anthony Davis were honorary pallbearers at Benson's funeral in St. Louis Cathedral. Davis said it was an honor he would cherish as long as he lived.
Wow.
What?
How many times do you think they kicked it? I mean,
somebody needs to send this to my guy AD, because he needs to cherish other things a lot more than cherishes this honor. But in his eulogy for Benson, New Orleans Archbishop Gregory Amen said the following: Tom loved the city of New Orleans, and he gave so much to help the city. As he brought the Saints and Pelicans here, as he kept the Saints here in New Orleans as part of the rebuilding after Katrina and as a sign of hope to the city. That is a lovely sentiment that happens to be totally untrue. The thing that kept the Saints in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina was Hurricane Katrina, which, and I'll explain why in a second.
Huh.
As Joe Nocera laid out very well in a 2006 piece for the Times Magazine, this was a few months after Katrina, which was August 2005, Benson had negotiated a ridiculous sweetheart deal with the state long before the storm, one in which he personally got all of the concession money and the parking revenue from Saints games.
Wait, like, what?
Went straight to him. He also got, in addition to like just having a ridiculous like rent deal with the Superdome, it's not like he owned the stadium. They just like gave him all of this, like all of the revenue from it. He additionally every year got $18 million just as like straight cash. The state would just like give him money.
For what reason?
Just for not moving the team.
Oh my
like
God.
He would just continually extort the state and be like, I'm not really happy with my deal. And they just renegotiated. And the state with like chronic budget problems would just give him $18 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, this wasn't good enough for Tom Benson. He wanted a new stadium, is all sports owners do. He was always threatening to leave if he didn't get one. Then Katrina happens, August 2005. The team plays three of its home games in San Antonio that year, if you guys remember. They played four games in Tiger Stadium at LSU, and they played one quote-unquote home game at Giant Stadium.
And the Superdome, obviously, is where like everyone found refuge during the storm.
Superdome is where everyone found refuge, obviously. Not only was, you know, the Superdome taken up by other more, you know, other things, but the building was not in any condition to host a football team. The city was obviously in no condition to host a team that year. So they had these various temporary homes. So the mayor of San Antonio is like circling this situation, vulture that he is, says that he was in October of 2005, says he's comfortable in saying Benson wanted to move the team to San Antonio permanently. In December, ESPN reported that Benson might sue the league to keep the team in San Antonio if the league wanted to demand that they move back to New Orleans. So at that point, it looked like Benson was going to use Katrina as an excuse to move the franchise to a city that would give him more money and give him a new stadium. But, and this is back to the Joe Nocera piece from 2006, he argues very persuasively the fact that Katrina devastated the city ultimately made it such that it was just politically untenable for Benson to be able to move the team. And they probably would have moved. He would have gotten out and gotten the new stadium out of San Antonio if Katrina hadn't happened. So it was the NFL. We all like hate on the NFL, and the NFL sucks. Don't get me wrong. But it was the NFL, and it was Commissioner Paul Tagliabue as Nasser wrote in his piece, who insisted that the Saints play games in Louisiana during that season. He persuaded the state and Benson to delay the out clause in his lease by a year to give everyone more time to figure out how to proceed. It was Tagliabue who had the NFL deal directly with Superdome officials overseeing the repair of the stadium. It wasn't Benson who did that. It was the NFL. Yeah. And it was Tagliabue who announced that the Saints would play in New Orleans, who basically demanded that the Saints play in New Orleans for the 2006 season. And, you know, I think you guys probably remember that first game back against the Falcons.
It was like one of the game, right?
Yeah. One of the best, you know, moments of rebuilding after Katrina. Steve Gleason blocked the punt. It was like unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Tom Benson didn't want to do that.
Absolutely.
He wanted to be gone by then. The Saints, of course, have been in the city every year since. They won the Super Bowl in 2010.
And the Super Bowl win was like painted as like, this is part of the city's comeback, right?
It was. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the years after that controversy, Benson has said that all that stuff about moving the team was blown out of proportion.
Of course.
Which is a total crock. It's, you know, let's even stipulate that it was blown out of proportion, which I don't believe in, but let's just take his word for it. Mm-hmm. Even so, it is undeniable that in the like months after Katrina, when the city and its people like needed leaders and civic institutions to step up and stand up and say, we are standing behind the city, we are going to be here, we are going to be a part of the rebuilding. He definitely never said that. Mm-hmm. And he led New Orleanians to believe that he was looking for a way out. And the reason that New Orleanians believed he was looking for a way out is because he was looking for a way out. So that line from the eulogy about Benson keeping the Saints here as part of the rebuilding after Katrina as a sign of hope to the city is really a perverse attempt to rewrite history. So whenever it is that Paul Tagliabue dies, I'm flying down for his second line. I'm not second lining for Tom Benson. That is our show for today. Thank you very much to the great Gene Demby for coming on.
Thank you, man. Appreciate you.
Joel Anderson of ESPN. Always appreciate you coming on the show, sir.
Oh, my pleasure, man. It's always fun.
Our producer is Patrick Fort, and filling in for him today are Danielle Hewitt and Mary Wilson. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. This week, I want to endorse the Slate Spoiler Special podcast, wherein they dispense with the dumb convention that reviewers shouldn't tell you what happens in the movie, and they just tell you what goddamn happens in the goddamn movie. It is really quite glorious. You should listen and subscribe wherever and however you get your podcasts. It is the Slate Spoiler Special. I am Josh Levine. Remember Zelma Beatty, and thanks for listening.